Okay, so today's talk I'm calling The Value of Ritual, which is very appropriate because we just finished our Tsatsiki festival, which is there's one dedication. I can't remember where it's from, but basically that's what the chant leader says after the ceremony, chants out loud by themselves. And it was something about, we have made much ceremonial. I feel like that's very appropriate after this kind of thing, where there's like there's processions and instruments and special altars and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, I thought it would be appropriate to talk about ritual and the value of ritual generally, and also how it appears in Zen. And yeah, my experience personally when I got into Zen, when I was at the sweet young age of 24, I was skeptical about religion and devotion and all that. So the first, I remember first getting my first little Buddha image, which just ended up being one of those little Hotes, which isn't really a Buddha, but you know, what did I know at the time? And just to make an to like put it on an altar felt strangely sinful, having been a Catholic in my background, you know, like, you know, graven images on altars, and you know, but I got used to it, and I was surprised at the power of the rituals that I and ceremonies that I encountered at Dharmarain Zen Center, and how, you know, there's something about them that got at me in a different way. And I tend to be very intellectual and skeptical, and the ceremony tended to touch me in a different way. Like, we have the festival of the Buddha's birth, and you know, we put a little Buddha statue in a bowl of sweet tea, and each of us has, there's a little ladle, and each of us, you know, files by the altar and has a chance to pour sweet tea over the baby Buddha's head. And you know, I mean, you just sound like, okay, whatever. Maybe the Buddha existed, maybe he didn't, you know, with sweet tea and a ladle. But there's just something, you know, it touched something in me. Whenever I do that, I'm like, So, you know, I'm defining ritual because there's many different ways to define it, but a deliberate sequence of activities involving gestures, words, actions, or revered objects. And the key is that a ritual is physical. It's some kind of tangible, visible thing, something we enact or do or touch or something. So I'm going to do something very unusual, and I'm going to have us watch a video. This is about 13, 14 minutes long, which is a little long, but it's very engaging. It's something that my husband actually turned me on to, and some of you may be familiar with. This guy does these YouTube videos, and it's called Religion for Breakfast. And this is his baseball magic video. So it'll be self-explanatory, and I think it'll lead into some really interesting discussion about ritual. So bear with me as I try to share my screen and share the video, and hopefully all of you will be able to hear it and see it, including those in the dirt sendo. So, if it's not working after you give me a second or two to get it working, just like unmute yourself and be like, not working, can't hear it, whatever. Because I don't want you to have to sit there for almost 15 minutes without being able to appreciate this. So, I will. I'm not sure. Do I share and then start the video? Hopefully, I can do that. Okay. Share sound, optimize for video clip. And then make this full screen. And then play.
Phrase, Tiger Stadium, home of the Detroit Tigers, transformed into an anthropology classroom. Fans would have watched their pitcher, Mark the Bird Fidrich, deep in conversation with his baseball. Fidrich believed that every baseball had its own life, its own predetermined quota of hits, so he'd talk to the baseball before the pitch, giving it instructions. He'd also get on his hands and knees and engage in, let's say, a ritualized cleansing of the mound, sweeping away his cleat marks to ensure that it was just right for his next pitch. Fidrich is far from the only example of elaborate baseball rituals. Shortstop Nomar Garciaparra had a meticulous pre-at-bat routine, adjusting and readjusting his batting gloves before each pitch. Some settle into their batting stance in the exact same way every single time, like former Phillies first baseman Ryan Howard. Right fielder Larry Walker was captivated by the number 3. He wore the number 33, would set his alarm clock at 33 past the hour, and made sure that his wedding vows took place on November 3rd at precisely 3:33. This all stretches back to the earliest decades of the game, with baseball players ritually arranging bats, moving things back and forth on the field, and spitting in their gloves. From the rally cap to meticulous batting stances, to announcers refusing to mention a no-hitter before it happens, baseball has been thoroughly imbued with taboos and rituals, and anthropologists of religion have noticed. Back in the 1970s, the anthropologist George Gmelch suggested that these actions are not mere superstition, but an example of a universal human tendency to use ritual to manage uncertainty and exert a semblance of control in unpredictable situations. In the high-stakes realm of professional baseball, uncertainty is the only constant, and rituals become vital psychological anchors that ground the players. In other words, players turn to baseball magic.
One simple but brilliant trick to heat your home in 90 seconds and save thousands of dollars on your
Yeah,
heating
all
bill
right.
this winter.
George Gmelch has had an unlikely career path for an academic, from professional baseball player to professional anthropologist. Back in the 60s, he played for the Tigers organization, but then he took a college class on magic, religion, and witchcraft that changed his life. In this class, he learned about one of the first anthropologists to critically examine why people do magical rituals, Bronislaw Malinowski. In the early 20th century, Malinowski studied the people of the Trobriand Islands, now part of the country of Papua New Guinea in the Western Pacific. One of his more long-lasting contributions to anthropology came from observing the islanders' fishing practices. When fishing outside of the lagoon on the open sea, the Trobriand fishermen performed elaborate rituals, aiming to ensure their safety and a big catch. In contrast, no such rituals were performed when fishing in the safer, more predictable lagoon. Malinowski theorized that these rituals were a way to deal with the uncertainty and danger of open sea fishing. His observations influenced later generations of anthropologists who study magic. In cultures all over the world, certain types of rituals seem to appear around liminal, uncertain, or dangerous moments in everyday life. In the world of Greco-Roman magic, for example, we see rituals like protective incantations and amulets that aim to protect women during childbirth, curse tablets that attempt to destroy rival business owners, or healing incantations to get rid of a migraine. These are the kind of small, mundane rituals that were created to deal with the crises that people face in everyday life. As soon as Gmelch heard about Malinowski in his college classroom, his thoughts immediately went to baseball. A professional baseball game certainly ranks high on the list of uncertain situations. Careers hinge on a single pitch, a single swing, a single overzealous fan getting in the way. And unsurprisingly, in this social context, we see a ton of baseball magic, ritual behavior which does not have a clear technical function in the execution of skill, yet which is believed to control other external factors. Gmelch focused on baseball, but we see this in all types of sports. Consider Maria Sharapova, the Russian tennis player who won an Olympic medal and was considered one of the best players of her generation. Sharapova was famous for her highly particular pre-serve routine. Although it evolved over the years, there were several key features. Sharapova typically started by turning her back to the court, pacing a few steps and adjusting her strings before approaching the baseline. She would brush her hair behind her ears, left side and then right, then slowly and deliberately bounce the ball, usually twice, before finally winding up for the serve. Serena Williams, also considered one of the greatest tennis players of all time, also had pre-game and pre-serve routines. For For example, she generally bounced the ball exactly 5 times on her first serve. During an interview, she even jokingly blamed a loss on failing to follow through with her rituals.
What happened?
I didn't tie my shoes right.
That's what it is. Yeah. How many times did you bounce that ball?
And I didn't do it 5 times.
You see?
Some scholars call these sets of ritual behaviors pre-performance routines, or PPRs, a systematic sequence of actions that players do before their performance of a specific athletic skill. Researchers have suggested that pre-performance routines are effective because they, number one, enhance concentration. Two, they combat what's called warm-up decrement, which is when a player's performance deteriorates due to a delay or pause. And third, they aid in automatic skill execution. In other words, pre-performance routines prevent the athlete from overthinking and trying to consciously control what's already an innate skill. Scholars go further and distinguish between causally opaque versus causally transparent actions. There's a very transparent reason why a basketball player might pretend to shoot a free throw a few times before actually attempting it, or why a batter will take a few practice swings before stepping into the box. They're simulating the actual thing they're about to attempt. But there are other athletic rituals where the relationship to the performance is much more opaque. There's no transparent causal connection between talking to the ball before a pitch, or hitting your cleats with your bat, or refusing to shave your beard to maintain a winning streak, or kissing the ball. Have I mentioned there's a lot of kissing? The connection between these actions and a successful execution of your task is opaque, seemingly less empirical. Magical thinking, if you will. Some of Sharapova's pre-performance rituals are causally transparent, like getting hair out of your eyes, while others are causally opaque, like emphatically bouncing the ball exactly twice. Interestingly, at least one study found that there may be very little performance difference when using a more causally transparent method like a PPR and a completely opaque strategy, like wearing lucky socks, touching a lucky pendant, or wearing a golden thong, like Yankees' Jason Giambi was known to do whenever he needed to break out of a slump. Both strategies worked, and performance was worse without either. Following Malinowski, Gmelch argued that athletes developed ritualized behaviors, many of them highly personal and idiosyncratic, many of them causally opaque, as a way to create a sense of control and predictability in this high-stress, high-uncertainty environment. He noted that we especially see high levels of ritualization among pitchers and batters, not among fielders. He argued this is because fielding has much less uncertainty. He says compared with the pitcher or the hitter, the fielder has little to worry about. He knows that in better than 9.7 times out of 10, he will execute his task flawlessly. Meanwhile, batters and pitchers are under near constant stress and uncertainty with pitch after pitch after pitch. Even the best pitch can be crushed for a base hit. Or maybe a batter makes great contact, but the ball goes straight to an outfielder. Goalies in ice hockey, who are basically in a state of near constant awareness and expectation, likewise have been shown to engage in higher levels of ritual behavior. Gmelch published his article Baseball Magic in 1971, even before Fidrich took the mound chatting with his baseball. But ever since then, Gmelch's uncertainty hypothesis has been corroborated by psychologists and anthropologists. Across all sports, athletes engage in ritual behavior more when the outcome of a situation is increasingly uncertain. A controlled experiment published in 2011 found that athletes do more rituals when facing tougher opponents, or when the stakes are higher, like during the playoffs. Moreover, high-level competitors like professional athletes are more likely to engage in ritual behavior compared to low-level or amateur athletes. Other studies have backed this up, demonstrating that whether we're talking about a golf putt or a free throw shot, elite athletes take a much longer time with their pre-shot routines compared to less elite athletes. And Olympic medal winners have much more consistent pre-performance routines compared to non-medalists. The researchers concluded that sports-related rituals reduce psychological tension in elite players. In other words, the rituals regulate emotions and help to switch from a negative to positive mindset. In the face of immense pressure and stress, a ritual is something you can control, and that sense of control matters. One team of researchers found that even completely arbitrary daily rituals can help mitigate negative emotional responses to failure. In other words, people who do more rituals experience less negativity when they mess up, which makes ritualized behavior something like an emotional regulatory tool. This might help to explain baseball magic. Even a very good batter is only going to hit the ball 1 out of every 3 trips to the plate. So they experience a ton of failure. But because rituals can function as a palliative against anxiety and failure, as the researchers put it, these baseball rituals may dull the negative emotional response, keeping your mind clear and ready to deal with the next performance, the next at-bat, the next serve. What's interesting is that the study also found that the rituals didn't help or hinder actual performance, but they did seem to help achieve an optimal mental comfort zone. In fact, the body of research on this topic is not all that clear to what degree sports magic actually helps. There are so many confounding factors at play, like the skill of the athlete and the unique conditions of any given game. But scholars generally agree that cognitive factors like a perceived sense of control over situation and less anxiety can improve our performance in sports, and rituals have been shown to enhance these mental states. Some athletes have said as much. The tennis player Rafael Nadal engages in a bunch of ritualized behavior. He always ensures that his water bottles are perfectly aligned. He jumps up and down at the net during coin tosses, and before serving, he touches his nose, tucks his hair behind his ears, and famously fixes his shorts. In his autobiography, Nadal said, "Some call it superstition, but it's not. If it were superstition, why would I keep doing the same thing over and over, whether I win or lose? It's a way of placing myself in a match, ordering my surroundings to match the order I seek in my head." His own explanation for why he does all this seems to mirror what psychologists and anthropologists have found, that rituals can act as a mental regulatory system, acting as a buffer against uncertainty and anxiety. This extends to war as well. The anthropologist Richard Sosis found that individuals who experienced war-related trauma, like losing a family member or a close friend, often engaged in rituals more frequently, which appears to be linked with decreased levels of anxiety. When talking about baseball magic, the word superstition is thrown around a lot, and many athletes, when interviewed about their behavior, categorically reject this term. No doubt because superstition is usually a pejorative term that implies that these behaviors are ineffective or irrational. Nadal's response to this accusation is an interesting data point to scholars of religion everywhere. If it were superstition, why would I keep doing the same thing over and over, whether I win or lose? We can ask the same question about the history of religion. If rituals like these are so obviously irrational and lack a causal explanation, as the anthropologists say, why have humans been doing magic like this for thousands of years up until today? One explanation is that this is due to a quirk in our human cognition. This is a common argument in the cognitive science of religion. For example, the anthropologist Dimitri Zigalitas conducted an experiment on audiences at NCAA basketball games and found that when fans see a player do a pre-shot ritual before a free throw, they evaluate that player to be more likely to make the shot. His team concluded that even in non-religious contexts, people make intuitive, automatic judgments that rituals work, which he and other scholars argue is the result of an evolved cognitive bias. Though, as we've seen, it'd be inaccurate to say doing a ritual like kissing a ball before you throw it does nothing to affect the outcome of the game. It does seem to do something, at the very least, to help achieve an optimal mental state in a stressful situation. In the words of Harvard anthropologist Michael Jackson, yes, that's actually his name, "If we place more emphasis on internal inductive effects of magical ritual, the gap between pre-modern irrationality and modern rationality is significantly narrowed. All human beings seek to augment and increase, by all means possible, their capacity for effectively working on the world. Thus, humans throughout history have developed all manner of seemingly unproductive rituals to augment their ability to thrive in a world constantly trying to thwart us, especially in liminal and uncertain situations. Critically, these rituals don't replace human action. It's not like the Trobriand Islanders chanted their open sea fishing incantation and then sat back and did nothing. They still employed their expert sailing and fishing skills to ensure a good catch. It's not like an ancient Roman shopkeeper cursed the guy next door and then stopped attempting to undercut the guy's prices. In the same way, the athletes that engage in sports magic are not only relying on the ritual. When they cleanse the mound or walk a particular way before a serve, they're using these repetitive motions as an augment to their skill, and teaching us something about ritual in the process. As the anthropologist Stanley Tambaya says, "All ritual uses a technique which attempts to restructure and integrate the minds and emotions of the actors. All ritual, whether we're talking about baseball magic, purification rituals, or burial, one of..."
He goes on to an ad now. All right. stop the share. Hopefully that was edifying. So I particularly love that one last thing. All ritual uses a technique which attempts to restructure and integrate the minds and emotions of the actors. So when I think about this, you know, doing a ritual, whether it is something as simple as, you know, you get up, you have your morning coffee, you sit in a particular place, you take out the newspaper, you let your cat sit on your lap, you know, whatever, you know, that kind of personal ritual, or, you know, something elaborate like we did today, something shared, appearing kind of like a, I'm hearing myself again.
Really?
Yeah. This is very faint. Maybe it's your earbud that I gave you.
I will.
Anyway, it's not a big deal. Right. So when I think about this and I think about physically enacting something, like we did today with Tsujiki, right? So this, it's very common, right? Particularly this time of year in the fall for people in all kinds of cultures to do ceremonies and rituals around death, right? Everything is kind of, I mean, I don't know what Southern Hemisphere, they must have different timing, but you know, around autumn, things are starting to die, and the, so we start to think about death, and we start to think there is this kind of liminal time where the dead and the living come closer together, and you know, we all struggle with fear of death, and we struggle with the sense of loss of people and beings. So to do rituals around these things helps us. Helps us, you know, ground us, integrate us. Again, it usually defies description, right? Because you're not like, well, I'm going to do a ritual and this is exactly what's going to go on in my mind and how I'm going to feel. You know, it's more of a gestalt action than that, right? But, you know, I will find myself, I don't know, I don't necessarily agree with this, the Religion for Breakfast guys. You know, he used the word control a lot. I don't really get a sense that the rituals give me more of a sense of control, but maybe, you know, I'm able to deal, you know, I'm able to deal a little better. Particularly during Tsujiki, one of the things which we don't get into a lot because we're just doing the one ceremony, but it's usually done in the context of a 3-day retreat. And the retreat we do, like, it's kind of the idea is you invite all of your uninvited, all of your unresolved karma to be with you that weekend. All of your unresolved stuff. Just kind of, just like we open the door behind the altar to let the ghosts in. We kind of just, all right, I'm going to open the doors of my mind this weekend. Whatever I haven't been looking at, whatever I haven't wanted to face, I'm inviting it to come. You know, and you really do end up having that sense. And, you know, I had an experience at a Tsujiki ceremony where I had had a lot of difficulties with my family when I decided to ordain. They were fine if I just wanted to be a Buddhist, like it was a hobby. But if I really wanted to basically throw away my education and, you know, damage my career and have a giant empty spot in my resume and all this, you know, the practical concerns, they were upset about it. So I had a real sense of like not being understood by my family for a while. And it was a lot of kind of sadness. And I'm trying to explain to them and they're kind of like, don't want to hear about Buddhism. But at Tsujiki one time, I just had this sense that my grandfather, who was a devout Catholic and had passed away a number of years before, was somehow there. Just like he was wherever he was. And I don't really believe in any of this stuff, right? Not literally, but like had a sense wherever he was watching. And that from where he was, he understood. He understood what I was doing and, you know, was supportive. And like, I don't know, that shift, that heal, I wasn't even conscious of walking around in that ceremony thinking, my family doesn't understand me. But then when I experienced that, I realized there was something that healed in me. And I actually didn't have to keep on getting my living family to understand and accept, because like, well, grandpa understands. So we just never know, in a way, when we move into these kind of ceremonial or ritual spaces, what they're doing to us. And I think the most important ritual that we do as Zen Buddhists is Zazen. So this is another instance where we are enacting something. It's not just I'm a Buddhist because I walk around and I think about Buddhist stuff and I try in my mind to be good, but this is like I'm putting my body where my mouth is, right? I'm putting my body where my mind is. I want to just be present and still and in my, you know, awake and aware of my life for this period of time. And I'm physically doing that. So there's a, you know, it has an effect on us that we can't just understand up in the brain. Making it real. Because there's no real separation between body and mind anyway, right? It's not just physical. It's not just mental. So it's the fact that we sit there. I mean, the mind is still involved, right? The mind and heart and intention and all of those things are still involved in that act. So I guess I'll leave it there and open it up to questions or comments or anything you might want to share about your own experience or ritual. And Alice, our tennis player,
I have a lot of rituals and I feel like the magic word that you're trying to say is alignment.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, like, so when I serve, I have to make sure that my area that I'm standing at has no leaves, mm-hmm. it has no wet spots, and that I blow my nose far away near the fence, like I kind of do a snot rocket, so that like the airways are free. And then I kind of like dust off all the sand, and then I get in my stance. And then if it's a tie break, then I bounce 10 times and then I serve. But it's kind of like aligning my body and my mind together and kind of telling myself, this is important,
mm-hmm.
pay attention. So I'm not thinking about the other person. I'm not thinking about what they're thinking about me. I'm not thinking about anything at all other than this moment. And what's funny is that sometimes I don't do those rituals and I'm just casual, whatever. But one ritual in particular that brings a lot of anxiety if it's missed is when I play doubles. And this really ties in with Buddhism. When I play doubles, and let's say I make a mistake and I look back at my partner and he has a stink face. He's like, oh. And I go, oh my God, I just disappointed him so bad. But then we come together in the middle and we talk about strategy or not talk about strategy. But here's the ritual that really, really ties it in together. We have to touch each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like we either have to bump rackets or high five or do a fist bump. Mm-hmm. And then we go to our respective spots and go again. And I feel like no matter whether there's disappointment or upset or congratulation, we bump rackets, we bump each other to say, all right, we're in this together. Let's do this. And it's not really like making sure that we win or anything, but it's more like an alignment that we are together. And so in the Zendo, when there's that loud clap, like I feel that, okay, like everyone's on and like everyone is aligned and we're doing it together. So yeah, That's all I can think.
Thank you. Yes, I love that. And you're when you were talking about doing this, and you know, you're kind of centered in your body and not, you know, worrying and thinking about the opponent or whatever. It makes me think about our Shuso Hosen ceremony, which Shoketsu's done and Jinryu will do next in the spring, which is like a big, like, you know, if you've seen the Mondo ceremony, the question and answer, this is like, well, the Shuso is the only one presenting and everybody asks the question. And so it's this, you know, it's kind of a big deal. You're being tested on your understanding. And there's, but it involves all kinds of, like, you have to, you know, hold the stick and you have to hand it over and then you have to stand up and then you have to bow and get the stick back. And then you have to go process around the teacher sitting in the middle of the room. And then you know, bow to the teacher and then you get your verse. And like, there's all this ceremony involved, which is kind of hard to remember, right? But in a way, like, you're so worried about that, getting that form right, you're not thinking, oh my God, I've got to answer some questions. I wonder what kind of questions I'm going to get. You know, it's just like, okay, you know, so then you're really in your best state of mind to have it happen. Greg.
Hi. Yeah. So like in that video, they were talking about like the purpose of ritual in sports was because everything is so unpredictable. It gives you this option to introduce some predictability into a pretty chaotic situation, which sounds a lot like what we try to do in Zen, but also like we're supposed to kind of accept the fact that things are unpredictable and impermanent and suffering exists and learn to kind of cope with those things. And one of the things that tends to cause that suffering, from my understanding, is getting stuck into your own habits. Habits and rituals seem kind of pretty closely aligned to me. I guess I just have a question more along the lines of like, can you describe the difference between habits and rituals from a Zen perspective? And like, is a habit just a negative ritual or one that brings you out of alignment, while a ritual is more positive and brings you into alignment?
The first thing that runs through my mind, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of dimensions to this question, but the first thing that leaps into my mind is that habits would be not deliberate in a way. Like they're not mindful. They're not something you're choosing to do. They're kind of, unless you're just kind of, you're kind of stuck in a karmic pattern. So in a sense, there might be some choice, but whereas rituals are more like, you stop and choose to do this thing. Does that make sense?
I had the same thought.
You stop and choose to do the ritual. You're consciously choosing. I mean, the thing is that in some ways then rituals can become just habits and then they lose their effectiveness. Mm-hmm. So that's where, you know, like the ritual that we do in the Zendo, for instance, and we, you know, put our shoes straight and then we're all of us are in alignment and, you know, we bow to our seat and, you know, we're putting our body in alignment with like respect for the sitting space and various things like that. But after a while, you know how to do it and you can just go like this and it's not really having an effect anymore once you're just doing it mindlessly. So, Sarah, you were...
Oh, ma'am?
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. Ma'am. Stephen Jenkinson was a grief counselor in Toronto, his home, for 30 years. And he said that... Canadians and Americans are ritual deprived. And Michael Mead, who started Mosaic, which works with kids at risk, said we don't just live by logic alone. And I liked what Alice said. It's, as you said too, that it's about us coming together in a sense of community. I do a bit of numerology and the armistice ending World War I was signed at 11 a.m., 11 a.m. on the 11th month, on the 11th day, November. And that represents a spiritual effort. So whether people agreed with that or not, that was the time chosen. So mm-hmm. I think ritual, as you say, is something we can put meaning to as as beings. Thank you.
Thank you. And then Sarah and then Jinju.
I had a similar thought about the difference between ritual and habit or compulsion. You know, working with clients who have obsessive compulsive disorder, these are rituals that detract from their life and distract them. And I think that's the main difference, is when it's coming from an unconscious avoidance versus an intent, a positive intent, then it could serve to align you with something positive or keep you from acknowledging something about your present or your reality. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. Jinryu?
Yeah, I wanted to share very briefly an experience I had just about a month ago. You know, I grew up in a Protestant Christian church-going family. And so I had all of that ritual and ceremony. From time to time, a hymn will come into my mind. And as I came into Brightway Zen, this God of Moses that I had in my head was, he was like the Cheshire Cat. He was slowly disappearing like the cat it did in Alice in Wonderland. Doesn't mean he's not really there, or she. And so as you can hear in what I'm describing, I'm going back to my roots. It's inevitable for me, it seems. And so a month ago, I was diagnosed with COVID and I couldn't come to the retreat. And what happened was the week just before the retreat, I had my weekly commitment at the library, and there was a woman there that I hadn't seen in weeks because she'd been on a long vacation, and I hugged her. And as I hugged her, a little voice said in my head, "You should not be doing this, I swear." And then that evening, she sent me a text and said, "I'm so sorry, I just tested positive for COVID. I hope this doesn't screw up your week next week." And I texted her back and said, "Don't worry about it, it's all okay." And I immediately went upstairs to my bed and fell down on my knees and said, "Please God, don't let me get COVID." And I've been going to Brightway Zen since 2014. I know I haven't done that while I've been here. It's been years since I've done that. So I just wanted to share that a bit. And then a very quick question, and I'll be quiet. Mm-hmm. I think what I'm hearing is that ritual and form, you're using them rather interchangeably. Are you not, Demio?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So for anybody not familiar with that term form, you know, we have a lot of forms in Zen. And form in the sense of a kind of an established way that we do something. So essentially a shared ritual, even if they're very small. You come in, you put your, you know, shoes straight. That's one of our forms. Denny.
First of all, thank you for sharing that video. That was fascinating. We could talk about that for a couple months. But I've just been sitting here thinking about, because I have decades on most of you, I think, thinking about all the situations I've been in where I've either observed ritual or been involved in it myself. And the most recent is Zazen, of course. Even though I've been doing Zazen for quite a while. And I also include prayer in that, because when I was a kid, my family was not church going, but I lived in a very dysfunctional family, and I adopted the figure of Jesus as my best friend. And I created my own prayer rituals at night. And but even sports, both of my brothers were in sports, but it just seems to me that an important part of it is just surrendering something or responsibility for something of yourself to someone or something else. It's like the result you're desiring or you're hoping for or you're looking for is so overwhelming that you either want to share it in a community, which takes the pressure off just you and becomes something that you have support for, or there's something outside of yourself that you feel some special relationship with, and it's soothing, it's comforting, it's healing to just give it over or part of it over to that entity. even in sports, where I don't know the woman's name who's the tennis player, but you know, when you're just at that point in the game where there's so much at stake and you're just really, really feeling like you could either make it or break it in one moment. If you just connect with your partner, if you just touch each other and you just share it, you give it over. That's just the way I ended up thinking about it.
Thank you. Yeah, and there's the sense of I'll have Judith next. You know, you don't have to believe in an other power. I mean, or you don't have to be literal about it. You can. To me, I have a sense of something that is much, much, much greater than my ordinary limited perception. But it doesn't even seem appropriate to me to like localize that into some kind of deity or force.
Right.
But it is nonetheless much bigger. This mystery, like, I'm not making my heart beat. I'm not making my lungs exchange oxygen with the air. I'm not like, this is all so much bigger than us that in a way I feel like that's where we're entering that kind of liminal space that goes beyond just the individual. And I, you know, there's ceremony and ritual can be healing in ways that we don't even expect. Like, one of our, we don't do yet at Bright Way, maybe someday. It's quite an elaborate ceremony. They do it at, still do it at Dharma Rain, where part of it is it's basically a sangha. It's the ceremony of like contrition. And you receive a little piece of paper. You're walking along in a long procession, and there's three altars. There's like three priests, three abbots, and these little on, you know, they make these little altars and like doorways and stuff. And then the first one, you receive the slip of paper that represents your karma. And in the second one, you put it in that priest has a bowl. So you put it in their bowl. And then the third one, In the third one, there are geishas standing on either side of the priest, and they sing, they recite the karma verse for you, all my past and harmful karma. And then we did this in the basement. And then we climbed up the stairs, and at the top of the stairs, somebody was singing for each person, Om to the one who leaps beyond all fear. And the first time I did that, I was like, I didn't know. I didn't know I needed that. That was my first thought, like, wow, I didn't know I needed that. I didn't know that I had this sense of heavy karma, and that, you know, in this context, somebody's inviting me to let it go. And then the three priests or teachers bring all those karma slips up in a big urn, and then they set them on fire, and they poke at the fire, and they set it on fire. And then at a certain point, they all three let out this yell. And it's just like, boo! It's very, very powerful, you know? Very cool. Judith.
Oh, that's a hard one to follow. Wow. Okay. Well, this is the primitive end of, because when you were showing all that, I suddenly remembered step on a crack and break your mother's back.
Uh-huh.
And so what that meant to me at the time is that there were dark forces out there. You know, you're like, what are you, 8, 7, 6? Mm-hmm. And something can break your mother's back. Mm-hmm. And if you aren't careful, you can bring harm to your mother, mm-hmm. who may already be harmed. You see her as being harmed. So we were assiduous in not stepping on the damn cracks. And now I think about one little more thing. For me, the ritual, which in my case is probably burning incense, is that, you know, there, the world is so mysterious, and there are all these elements out there. And you have experienced serendipity and luck, good and bad. And you need to focus on something so that you can keep those, the negative forces away. Mm-hmm. Sounds a little psychotic, but it can work.
Yeah. Thank you. Cedar.
So I was thinking of my art therapy program in Santa Fe, and the fact that there was a lot of Native American ceremony involved in that.
Mm.
And I did bring up the question, why do we need this ceremony? It seems like we could just go to this point. And I didn't really get a straight answer from anybody, but what I found over time was that I would experience something within that ceremony to give credence to the fact that the ceremony was needed.
Mm-hmm.
And that to have that space where supportive spirits would come in and actually transform something within you, and to have that acknowledged because you were experiencing it. And that's why I felt that the ceremony is began to feel that that was important to be involved with.
Thank you. So my latest idea is to, because as many of you know, I've tried different forms of climate activism, and you know, burned out on this, burned out on that. What should I? So the latest thing I'm trying with the help of a couple of our Sangha members is to organize interfaith ceremonies that address our distress about the state of our planet. And in particular, I like the idea of them happening in significant places. You know, this is like a concern about what's happening to the environment, to the land. So being somewhere where destruction has occurred or is occurring, or maybe decisions are being made about destruction, et cetera, significant places, and to bring ourselves there physically, and then to do some kind of ceremonial, you know, whether that's silent meditation or prayer, singing, guided meditation, you know, ceremonial action, something. And just that, I mean, there's even just some power, even just when, you know, a few of us are going to give one of these actions a little dress rehearsal next Saturday. And even just, you know, four people being present with a common intention already has this kind of ritual aspect to it. Just like we've physically gone somewhere, we are physically together, and then we are enacting some kind of intention. And I feel like, just like you said, the ritual does not replace action, right? But the ritual can put us in a good place for action. And there are many, many, many ways to take action on climate, as I'm discovering. You know, it's actually quite humbling. It's like, well, we should go out and do something. And we're like, oh, well, they're doing that, and they're doing that, and they're doing that, and they're doing that. And you can join all kinds of actions and groups and doing wonderful work. So it's like, well, what could we offer? And if we offer this kind of interfaith ceremony to help sustain and connect the people being involved in all of this stuff, then maybe, I don't know, we'll see where it'll go. What will keep you in tune about that? Well, that brings us to 12:15. Jinri, do you have a last minute?
Yeah, it's really just less than a minute. But in what you were talking about, this interfaith thing you're doing that is becoming ceremonial, I think the best definition I liked in that video was Rafael Nadal's one, which is, I know we'll not get the words right, but it was something like his little ritual brought him to the game. This was, now he was in the game once he did that. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I heard that from Alice as well. Mm-hmm. So I just thought I'd throw that out.
Thank you. Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. It was wonderful.